In 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hello and welcome to Crikey's Film Discussion Podcast, the Parallax Podcast. I'm Luke Buckmaster.
And I'm Rich Harity. This episode we continue our series of inviting notable Australians to join us to discuss a film topic of their choice.
It's our pleasure to be joined by a man who rose to fame in the mid-80s as one third of Aussie musical comedy trio, the Doug Anthony All-Stars.
He has written for and starred in a smattering of TV programs, including The Big Gig, Funky Squad, 20 to 1, Unreal TV, The Glass House, Good News Week, and Don't Forget Your Toothbrush.
He ran against Andrew Peacock for the seat of Kooyong in 1990 with a policy that Vegemite jars should be loosened and procured 3.7% of the vote.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And he currently lectures about comedy at the Victorian College of Arts and in 2010 released a comedy writing manual titled The Cheeky Monkey.
In 1995, he published a novel that remained on Australia's bestseller list for 3 months, titled Left, Right and Centre, A Tale of Greed, Sex and Power, which sounds like a normal weekend for you, Rich.
Well, I don't know about the power part. But he also owns one of, if not the largest collection of Star Wars toys in the Southern Hemisphere. We'll get to the bottom of that soon, I'm sure.
And he's running this year for a seat in the Australian Senate, pushing a mandate that no policies equals no promises equals no disappointment.
He also has a show playing at this year's Melbourne International Comedy Festival titled Carry a Big Stick, which reflects on his career and his ongoing battle with multiple sclerosis.
Well, this sounds like Who Am I? Sailor Century.
It does, doesn't it?
Special, but it's not. It's the Parallax Podcast, and a very special welcome to you, Mr. Tim Ferguson.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Ian Turpie.
Oh, Ian wasn't available today.
Oh,
we tried him first. We tried him first.
Oh, yeah, he's hard to get a hold of these days. Hey, Luke. Hey, Rich. Hi. And hello, listeners of Crikey.
And how are you, Tim?
Going fabulously. Getting Excellent. Ready for the comedy festival. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be emotional. There are going to be tears. There are going to be people caught on the stairs wondering which way they should go.
And they might even end up in your show.
Yeah, quite often we just get a lot of accidental walk-ins who are trying to get to Will Anderson's show, but they just get lost.
Just looking for a seat.
Yeah. Well, as long as it's their tears and not yours. I think you're in a good situation there. Make the audience cry and maybe even laugh, but the percentage is going okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of look like Will Anderson on my good day.
So, before we go on, as we noted in our rather long intro, I just wanted to say, or ask you rather, with relation to you running for the Senate, will there be or can there be any film policy reveals on this program? I know you said no policy, but can you bend a little bit on that?
I can't bend on that because no policies means no policies, no promises. But what I can insinuate to the Australian people is that there will be more films with, wait for it, a story.
Ooh.
With a character called a protagonist who wants something and finds that there's something in their way and crazy stuff like that.
That almost sounds like actual screenwriting.
It's actual screenwriting, yes. Not your usual sort of came out of the 1980s where we were doing phonetic spelling, but screenwriting where you have to obey a principle as opposed to just invent one because you come from a country full of ex-convicts.
And that's a good segue onto the topic that you've selected, which is more along the lines of, let you explain it yourself, but genre and Australian film. But can you explain to us why you've chosen this particular conversational hotbed?
Well, for people who aren't sure what genre is genus. It's the beginning. It's the seed of a story. And so you can use the same seed in different pot plants to create entirely different trees. So a horror seed, you put a horror seed in a science fiction film and you end up with Alien. Oh man, how can they cut off the power? They're animals, you know, Alien or Aliens. Again, two different, entirely different films, but from the same seed. But you can take the horror seed and then you can make Friday the 13th, you can make Wolf Creek. But it all stems from the same elements and the same kind of story spine. And you can do the same thing with romantic comedies. You can either do Notting Hill or go all the way back to Midsummer Night's Dream. They're both romantic comedies. Who'd have thunk you could end up with two stories so entirely different yet somehow the same?
So the connection to Australian film, do you feel like Australian film lacks this ability?
I'm sensing a bridge here. I am suspending a bridge to the Australian film industry.
Yeah, so is there a problem here with Australian film and their inability to sow these seeds?
It is not an inability, Rich. I'll tell you what it is. It is a resistance to genre because it's historic. It's all about history. Australia started, or modern Australia started as a convict colony. And what that means is that the majority of the population didn't have keys. They didn't have money. They were male. They didn't have women. And they didn't have status. They were just a bunch of convicts who used to kill the English, and who wouldn't? And so, so what that meant was, part of DNA, the DNA of Australia, is to not make a big thing of yourself, not to have wealth, not to have a woman, not to have status, which is why Australians all carry on about the ridiculous idea that we are all equal in some way. The ridiculous idea that, yeah, you shouldn't go putting notes on yourself and you shouldn't make too big of yourself. Australia is the only country in the world that has a tall poppy syndrome, and that comes from the convict period. Now, if that is so, and of course it is because I just said it, if that is so, then there must be something in the way our screenwriters write, in the way our creators create, and in the way even our funding bodies fund, that goes way back, well, in fact, not way back, a couple of hundred years, to this convict streak. So if you look at a lot of Australian films, what they do is disparage genre. They disparage even things like a three-act story, because that's what, that's what the man does. The man does that. The warden of the prison makes three-act stories. So we're going to try something different. We're going to make a story without a story. We're going to call it Japanese Story. And the story is going to feature...
For example, just to pluck a wild hypothetical title.
Yeah, I'm just picking the word Japanese. We're going to have a geologist. She meets this Japanese guy. She's got to hang around him. They don't speak the lingo, but they do get a little bit horny, and who doesn't? So they have sex. Then... through no fault of his own, through no character trait of his own, for no goddamn reason apart from, well, you want him to die, he jumps into a creek and breaks his neck and dies. And that is the
best
end.
Review I've ever heard of.
Yeah, that's the end.
Yeah.
Now, I know the producer, I've met the writers, and they're wonderful people, but there's no goddamn story, because the thing, the inciting incident, firstly, comes way too late. Secondly, it fogs who actually is the protagonist in the story. And thirdly, and most importantly, it becomes a tragedy way too late.
So it's intentionally reactionary?
Oh,
is that
God, Yeah. The people who wrote this aren't idiots. They've all been to screen school. The trouble is they went to screen school in Australia where such things are indulged. The idea that a story is what you say it is indulged. But we tried that with spelling. Ask any 15-year-old.
So, you can spell that way.
And I think from memory, A Japanese Story collected 11 AFI awards. I think it was a slow year that year, but it totally swept the board. I don't know what that says about quality. In fact, I can say a few things that perhaps says about quality. I didn't like that film much, but it sounds to me like you're saying, Tim, that these sort of films... funded by people, I don't want to verbal you, but funded by people who kind of push the money so it goes round in the same kind of circles, appealing to the latte-sipping hipster doofus crowd.
Oh, absolutely. The establishment, the Australian screen culture has an establishment, and they all come from Fitzroy or Darlinghurst. Now they come from Northcote because apparently, people who eat baba ganoush are now tolerated in part of Australia.
That's rich. That's you and Rich.
I bought some baba ganoush.
Oh, yeah. We were eating and it's just so tasty. Look, smell my fingers.
Oh, actually, no, the other hand.
So, yes, it's an establishment. Now, these are people who these days are between their 50s and 60s. And, of course, in the 1970s, these people were the groovers, the changers. just another generation of people who are going to break all the rules. But of course, now they're establishment. And if you want to get a tick from them, then you actually have to obey a few of their story tropes. One is, there is no story trope. And of course, the second is, you know, we just have to do anything so long as the Americans don't.
Mm.
Because the Americans now have the keys to the prison of film. And so we don't listen to them. Americans come out here and they're not telling us what to do. And just because a film is successful, wait for this, just because a film is successful doesn't mean it's any good. Only an Australian moron would ever try to push this idea. That it's why a film like Japanese Story won so many AFIs. It's because there was never a chance of it working in Britain, in Europe, or in America. Never. And it didn't. It died. It played, you know, it played Sundance or something, and a couple of lesbians, you know, rattled their bangles and thought it was great. But it was never going to get a broad release either in Australia, outside of Fitzroy or Darlinghurst, or anywhere else in the world. So why reward it? Why do this? It's rebellion. It is prisoner rebellion. These people have to be wiped away, all whipped. Wiped, whipped, I don't care.
But you can't honestly be arguing that, like, films should be more conformist. Is that what you're saying? Or more populist?
Oh, God, yes,
yeah,
I am.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it's a business. It's a business. And it's only because of government funding that someone decided, well, you get paid anyway if you produce such bilge. Government funding is of no help. It's absolutely no help in creating good movies.
You're not playing to the box office, you're playing to the criteria of funding. And
yeah, you're making something, firstly, politically correct, which is the opposite of comedy before you even talk about anything else. So what we have to do is, I would say, tear it all down and let the market decide. And the market is the people. The people who are going to pay $18 to see a movie. And if they want to go, then it's a good movie. And if they don't, it's crap.
Mm.
Now, I know that might ruffle a few feathers, but those feathers belong to the establishment. And I bet you, if you're listening to this right now and you're going, well, that's absurd, I bet you you live within 5 kilometres of the centre of a major city or on a farm. You don't live in a western suburb.
In the outer suburbs, yeah. And I guess the point I would add about genre and being sort of quote-unquote conformist, I don't think being a genre film actually makes it a conformist film, because it's really hard to write a good, pure action film. It's really good to write a rom-com. It's really hard to write a rom-com. You know, it's hard to do familiar stories well and do them a little bit differently. I think often the Australian film industry seems to go, well, here's a sports movie, but here's a rape drama at the same time. You know,
and look how that worked out.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't attract two audiences at once. When I was working at Channel 9, one of the producers, when I came in with some concept or other, to use saucy Channel 9 executive language, said you can't root two sheep at once. You've got to choose which sheep you want to root. Mm. And, you know, you want to go for a good-looking one.
Yeah, ideally.
Yeah, now, of course, you can have a genre hybrid, but that's still because there's just one sheep you want to root. You just figure that both genres will appeal. So that's why we don't make a lot of genre films. And it's why we're not practiced in it, which is why when people do attempt this, it's usually their first attempt and they don't get a second chance. And it's always going to take a couple of tries at any genre before you start to get it right. I figure the next Wolf Creek film, the Wolf Creek 2 film, sounds terrifying. I mean, it just sounds like...
The first one was incredibly scary.
Well, it's everything that Greg McLean thought he couldn't get away with in the first film. And it's all true. Like, it sounds just ghastly, but it's what his audience wants. Greg McLean knows his audience. He knows them very well. It's a smart guy. The next film's going to be, you know, it's going to break box office records.
Well, so speaking of Wolf Creek, though, you don't mind Australians working in genre and adding maybe a parochial spin to the genre?
Oh, God, yeah, you have to. Yeah. If you're writing a romantic comedy, as I've been with Edwina Rexton, it's a comedy romance, but we just based it at a bachelor spinster ball and a ute muster. And these are unlike any party on the face of the planet. So it could only be made in Australia. So when the Yanks read the script, they just went, my God, you people actually do this? Oh, we got to see this. Because, you know, we got guys in utes. They're going to want to drive in circles really fast. Hey, wait a second. That's a metaphor.
With that whole Australian note parochial element, how about we now use that as a segue to the only film we're talking about that isn't Australian during this podcast?
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life.
Life of Brian, yes, one of the great, it's a great three-act story. And of course, if you're not familiar with Life of Brian, it's because you probably live in the inner city. Life of Brian is the story of, it's almost like the neighbor of Jesus. A guy called Brian who gets mistaken for being a Messiah through no fault of his own.
So it's a very naughty boy.
Yeah, and it's the only non-Australian film you've chosen. And I'm guessing you chose it because it's a good example of comedy, I guess, that we should be working towards.
See, a comedy like Life of Brian, which has a lot of absurdist elements and all sorts of different joke types, nonetheless serves the four imperatives that every film and every TV show, no matter what it might be, even sport, have to fulfill. And that is to make an audience laugh, make them cry, make them horny, and make them think.
Tick, tick, tick. Ticking all the boxes for me. Isn't that also like part of the danger in coming up with this sort of comedy? You know, it's so broad in a sense and so varied. So Life of Brian is full of, it's got sight gags, it's got dialogue gags, it's got religious satire, it's got nudity, it's got really absurd kind of realism to it as well. Do you think there's a danger when you try and do something like this that it could be the sort of comedy that just goes completely wrong? And if so, what got it right?
It could have gone terribly wrong. I mean, all those elements put together. And also with the writers of Monty Python, who were known for creating anarchy, it could have gone terribly wrong, but it's got a strong story and it's got a very strong message. And it has two masks operating at once. And that's the beauty of Life of Brian. It's the beauty of every great drama, tragedy or comedy. And in this instance, you know, look at what happens. Brian, spoiler alert, Brian's hanging on a cross at the end.
It's all right, it's been 40 years.
Statute of limitations.
Yeah, I think we run with 3 months. Is that what you mean? Yeah, 3 months and that's it, yeah.
He loses the love of his life. You know, she abandons him. His mother abandons him, spits at him.
Mm.
And he hangs to death. He's going to die. It's about serious things. It's about how we choose messiahs because we want to, not because they deserve it. It bears serious examination. It makes us laugh, of course, and it makes us, if not cry, at least recognize that there's something terrible happening. And it makes us horny because Judith is naked in one scene, and so is Brian.
As is Brian. Oh, that's Brian.
Yes,
Brian.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, this is obviously a film that's very irreverent and very risque. And if it was released today, it would still, in my opinion, create sort of heat waves of controversy with the Catholic Church and everything. What's the value, in your opinion, of being risque? I know on One-on-One a couple of years ago, you said, I think you said, I'm 46 or I'm 47, it's getting harder for me to offend people. So what are your thoughts on offending people as a comedic tool? And I say this in the context of someone who really likes Seth MacFarlane's Oscars work and got absolutely flamed.
You did.
As a result of liking and finding his boob jokes and something quite funny.
For starters, they were hilarious and move out of Northcote if you didn't like them. What was the question?
The value of being offensive as a comedian. Oh. I had about four questions all in a row, all compounded in one.
The value of being offensive in terms of being comic or even dramatic is that, for starters, you want to get people talking and you want to get them thinking and you want to make people argue. I'm sure Seth MacFarlane knew that there would be arguments over his, you know, boob song. I saw your boobs, we saw your boobs. That was what he was singing. And, you know, I've seen boobs and I was all for that song. But the fact is, most of the time with offence, that people will be offended about something that doesn't actually relate to them. Having what they called, you know, a disablement of sorts. You know, I walk around with like a walker and I walk around with a walking stick. I'm perfectly happy to make jokes about this, and so are all my wheelie, walkie sticky friends.
Mm.
But there are people who have told me my show is offensive who stand on 2 feet, who don't experience multiple sclerosis or whatever it might be, but they're offended on behalf of someone else.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an older person's daughter who writes the letter because you made a joke about older people.
Would you be upset if I was making jokes about that?
God, no, bring it on.
So you're fine. Yeah, so there's it's not like you need to be a part of that community to be allowed to make jokes about it.
God, no, you're supposed to be chucking rocks from the outside. That's all about the surprise of comedy. Oh my God, can you believe they were doing that? We were watching something the other day. Somebody was asking me, about from Das Kapital, you know, what was the most offensive thing? And so we were watching these discs.
Which I believe is on DVD, coming out this week.
It's on DVD, coming out this
week. We did not plan this as a promo.
And they said, what was the most offensive bit? It's all offensive. There's nothing in it that's inoffensive.
But where's the line?
Where's the humour?
So is there a line, in your opinion, Tim?
The line is ever-changing depending who's listening.
Yeah.
The day after a tragedy, some people will say too soon, another will say not too soon. And you will find that the media will always jump on board and kick the hell out of, you know, say the Chaser when they do a, you know, segment about whatever it might be, because it's convenient for the media to do this. But that's because they don't understand the nature and purpose of comedy. The reason why people joke about things that are terrifying and recent and dark is to distance themselves and help the audience distance themselves from it.
So in terms of Australian cinema, where do you see Australian comedy? Especially, I guess, Australian film comedy. Is it in a problematic state, or...?
They're incredibly difficult to write, having tried to, you know, having spent years writing comedy for film. It's actually a much bigger challenge than I ever thought. I went in thinking, well, okay, so it's 3 half hours. That's 2 weeks, 2 weeks. So that's a 6 week project. Of course, it's a movie.
Bang, done.
Let's say 9 weeks and the script is written. But there are so many layers and characters, and there's a lot going on in a film script that have to be dealt with. So it's incredibly hard, but we've had some great comedies that have hit the screen, the most recent being Red Dog, being, you know, a largely comic film with dramatic elements. An Australian film, so of course they kill the dog.
And an incredibly popular film too, I might add. It's
$20 million at the box office. I mean, gigantic success. Who saw that coming? The second film you brought up that you want to kind of talk about today was Sunday Too Far Away, which is a film from the mid-70s, a sheep-shearing drama, I guess, with Jack Thompson.
A bloody Fair Dinkum sheep-shearing drama.
It is very bloody.
Films don't get any more Fair Dinkum and True Blue than Sunday Too Far Away.
Yeah. It is a bum-wobbling sheep-shearing.
there is that amazing scene where they're bum-wobbling.
Yes,
I was really curious when you brought it up, because I couldn't tell watching it again whether or not you were going to come onto this film on a critical capacity or for it. I really couldn't see which side you were coming from, because I felt like, yeah, this is an incredibly empty in terms of narrative film that's jammed full of Australianness, but it is regarded as a 70s classic of the new wave.
It's regarded as a very political Australian film. I remember going to see it with my Irish Catholic grandmother, and she spent the whole time going, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, because it gets into that union stuff. Like, it's all about the part unions.
Of the film is about the strike.
Yep.
And there's, you know, there's a wonderful low point when the old Shearer dies, and, you know, it's like Jack Thompson has lost his father. And so there's great emotional narrative movement in the whole thing. But, and minor stories. Jack Thompson trying to win the heart of the girl who lives, who's the son of the cocky, and Jack Thompson dealing with the loss of the cook and the fury of the new cook. So lots of small stories all building up to one great story, which is really a man going from a position of smashing his car in the middle of the bush, rolling his car, having nothing, having left some storm, to actually making something and having someone to fight for.
Is there a but here, though? A sense of but in terms of it maybe...
Well, there were two wobbling ones in the film.
Two wobbling ones.
Two spectacular wobbling buts.
In terms of having, you know, generic three-act structure, it wasn't there. But in terms of having a protagonist who starts to want something and then has to fight for it, and then in the end is a changed man, in a way it was all there. It's just the story shape was different.
And it's really interesting to look at this film through the context of a genre film, because what genre is it? And I started to watch this film, which looks visually like it's been left out in the sun. It's really sunbaked. It's got this orangey hue. It looks a bit like Waking Fright. It looks Van Dinkum Australian, like it was lying out in the desert. Someone picked up the film reels. And then I started thinking, well, it's almost a genre by production values. So you've got a really true blue protagonist, you've got this look of the film, you've got the performances, you've got the way that, I think it's Dusty Springfield or some bluegrass artist is sort of gives it a kind of bluegrassy kind of vibe on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
It almost feels like it's tapped into this genre that's above everything else, which is the Australiana kind of genre. And, you know, there's this old notion of what the American dream is and how you go about obtaining it, and this kind of search for how to represent the American dream. This film, for me, Sunday Too Far Away, seems to represent the Australian dream and these notions of you go to work, you find a job, you drink your money away, you earn enough for a keep, maybe a little bit more, you might find your woman, you fight for your right, you move on, you wait for the weekend. There's something just so quintessentially Australian about this film.
And you stand by your mates, which is a very important part of that. You stand by your mates no matter how flawed they might be, no matter, you know, how desperate they might be, you stand by them. So, I mean, the themes are strong and they're very Australian, but it's, if you haven't seen Sunday Too Far Away, it's a great story. That's the feeling we have. We've gone on this journey with this man who has changed through a series of seemingly unrelated events that have this underpinning theme of mateship.
And you mentioned the his like father figure style guy, and there's this strange scene where they're having a bit of a confrontation near the end, and Jack Thompson says, "You're an alcoholic, mate," and they're about like, you know, spot the non-alco in the film, and the guy takes it so badly. He's like, "Oh, you don't mean that," and Jack Thompson's going, "No, you're a piss pot, mate." The guy's like, "You don't mean that? Oh, no, take it back." And I'm like, "Gee, is that the worst you could say of someone? You're an alcoholic." And I thought, "Oh, he's taking this really badly." And then the next scene, he dies. He's almost like he gets accused of being an alcoholic. And spoiler alert, too late actually. That's already and he pays for it with his life. I just thought that was a really death.
Yeah, look, I appreciate Sunday Too Far Away for what it is and where it stands in Australian film history. I just have a concern that maybe it influenced a stream of Australian film that has held back Australian cinema away from the genre-ness that you want it to go in, and that I maybe think it should go in too, and in terms of just that, like you said, that Australiana-ness.
Yeah.
And then that...
It's just a hard thing to get right.
It is, you know? And I appreciate Sunday Too Far Away for what it is, but historically it might have set a precedent that actually held cinema back a little bit.
Oh, you're quite right, Rich. That's because a lot of the things that really make that film work aren't apparent at first blush. And so if people use that as a template, they're not really looking at the film.
Because they're just, we'll set a film in
Australia. Yeah,
it's so hard to mimic.
Yeah, and have a bit of story here and a bit of story there and then have a punch up at the end.
Yeah.
Whereas all that stuff I mentioned about, you know, the way this man changes means it is a film and it is an entire story. But writing a film when nothing changes because, well, what does change? It might be a recognition of, you know, generally accepted truth, but it's not a story.
Mm.
It's not a movement of a character. And this guy changes due to all these events and the loss of his father figure and, you know, the forgiveness of his mate and the conquering of the monster. He goes through all of these trials and he gets there. Australian drama has failed to be drama. It is just, it's snapshots of characters. Nobody really changes because who really does change? These people have to be taught. One way to do it is by teaching them comedy. Because in comedy, as I mentioned to Luke before we started, in comedy we learn emotional distance from the characters. And you need that. A character, when you're writing a script, is just a rat on a slab. They're not a real person. What an absurd notion that a character in a film that you're writing is a real person. That's nonsense, even if it's a biopic. It can't be a real person.
Mm. Because the rhythms of interesting fiction, sorry to interject, aren't synchronistic with the rhythms of day-to-day life.
No, God no. I mean, people have to go to the toilet sometimes. They've got to go to sleep sometimes. And a story is always about, a great story is always about one characteristic that a person has, their most identifiable and active characteristic. And this is challenged. And they either maintain the characteristic, they change the characteristic, or they're destroyed.
So talking about you know, critical responses to film, I'm just interested in what would you give, what advice would you give your students in terms of how to deal with a negative review? And you're talking now to two film critics. You know, do you hate film critics? Do you love them? Or what advice do you give your students about dealing with a negative review? I know this isn't film per se.
Oh, I just hand them out at the end of, you know, a course, which is, you know, goes for months. A quote from Theodore Roosevelt, as quoted by Richard Milhouse Nixon, one of the great guys of history, that's called The Man in the Arena. And the man in the arena, he spoke about and said, better to be the man in the arena, and I'm paraphrasing, whose face is smeared in dust and blood, who strives valiantly in a great cause, than to be a critic, for the critic cannot lose. And he said, I would rather be a man in the arena than one of those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat.
Well, that about sums it up for us.
Well, there you go. I mean, you're film critics.
We can take it. We've got thick skins.
Well, let me put it to you. Look at your headstone. There you are. You've died, and there's your headstone. What's it going to say on it? Criticize the work of others with remarkable accuracy.
I imagine it would say something like, was a bit of a prick.
Yeah. Yeah. Was awkward to be with at some event.
Yeah.
Disagreed with everything I liked.
Or
was great in the sack.
Yeah, that's
That's a given, although afterwards you'll still be giving notes.
Yeah, I'll review that.
Yeah. You call that a climax? Yeah. So, you know, I would challenge you, as I did Fiona Scott Norman several years ago, I would challenge you to have a shot to do it, because on your headstone, it would probably be better to say, here is a person who was highly knowledgeable in the field, who then took a wild and crazy shot, putting everything at risk.
But do you feel like every critic needs to have tried to make a film to be able to validly criticise?
I think for their own sake, having criticised, they should say, I'm going to have a shot. And I'm just going to give it a go too. And I too will be a man in the arena, flawed, and I will screw up, and, you know, it'll all, It'll all be very difficult, but at the end of the day, in terms of a life arc, a critic has to eventually stand up and say, this is a film by Margaret and David.
Call it. I say we need a film from Margaret and
David.
I would
actually love to watch
that. Talk about box office. Well, I don't know about
what a selling point.
Yeah.
You go and see that. Margaret and David have written a rom-com.
Would it be writing, starring, directing?
I don't know.
Written by Margaret, starring David. We can ask those guys.
Yeah,
by
Margaret, starring David.
I don't know.
But you have to be a man or woman in the arena. Otherwise, what the hell are we doing here? What, you don't want to be a cold and timid soul who knows neither victory nor defeat. You can't lose if you're a critic. You can annoy people who will write you a stern letter, but you can't lose.
Hmm.
So which is why I don't really read crits, but apparently I've been told I've always been very lucky. It's suspicious. People love what I'm doing.
So have you ever had a review that you've been stung by or felt, you know, offended by, that's upset you?
No, not really, no, because they've always been nice.
In all your years of comedy, not one.
No, wow. Yeah. I mean, the All-Stars, people loved it. There was a guy who didn't like Don't Forget Your Toothbrush for all the reasons that I agreed with. It was way too entertaining. It was way too silly.
Maybe he was in the front row when you hurled maggots at him with a golf club. Yeah. That was around that time.
Yeah, I'm sure he did get a bit of food on his face.
Yeah.
So, if ever it's been a bad one, I always read it and think, oh, well, you know, yeah, that's probably true.
Mm.
And it's inevitable that occasionally someone will disagree with all of your efforts. But I just tell myself they're a cold and timid soul. Standing in the peanut gallery saying how you could have done it better and... the only trouble is there is no evidence to show how they could possibly know.
And talking about...
Fiona Scott Norman, by the way, is now one of Australia's most successful stand-up comedians because she said, okay, I've reviewed comedians, now I'm going to be one. And the woman's hilarious and glamorous and redhead at the same time.
But is there a role for critics in society? No, there isn't. Not even as an interim, like a catalyst between maybe the promotional machine and the audience or something.
Yeah, word of mouth will do it.
Yeah, okay.
So at the end of the day, have you ever read a critique and said, well, by George, I will go and see that film?
I haven't. I have.
Really?
I probably...
I think when I read it...
A review of Movie 43, but this is the opposite of what you were saying, saying how bad is this, then I said it. In terms of how good it was, maybe not as so much. But I've read a review that said this is just awful, you know, some sort of cinematic cyanide, and I've sort of said,
well, no,
how can I have some?
I will go on the record right now and say Movie 43 is one of the greatest pieces of cinematic genius of the last decade in America.
Thank you,
what
Jim Ferguson.
What is going on right
Thank
now?
Thank you, Jim Ferguson.
What gumnut would say, oh, I didn't like it because it's full of cheap gags. It's aimed at 15-year-old boys. What do you think 15-year-old boys want?
Not.
Character
That's
development?
I do not deny that 15-year-old boys will love that film. Like, and I'll happily say... And if you're 15 and a boy,
and you
go
know,
and see Movie 43. I'm
31 and I found that very funny.
I'm happy that you can embrace your 15-year-old boy inside.
If you can't embrace your 15-year-old boy inside, what can you embrace?
I think we should move on.
One step away from
We moved on. Briefly about cold and timid souls in relation to critics. Someone who's not a cold or timid soul is a Mad Max. I think I said a Mad Max, but really, there's just one of them. Mad Max 2, directed by George Miller in 1981, is the next film that we're talking about, the next film, Tim, that you want to talk about. A post-apocalyptic film with a hell of a lot of grunt and groan. I mean, this thing moves, baby. And it moves loud and thrashing, and by God, it's like roadside porn. I mean, in fact, In Mark Hartley's 2008 documentary, Not Quite Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino gave this great soundbite, and he said, talking about Australian filmmakers, he said, they managed to shoot Cars with this fetishistic lens that just makes you want to jerk off. And you watch Mad Max 2, and I think that's exactly the kind of film he's talking about.
Mad Max 2 is awesome. At heart, Mad Max 2 is a Western.
Yeah.
It's the what Robert McKee calls the fascist myth. The guy who comes into town, the outsider, and through violence alone, violence and rampant murder, wins the day. And everybody feels good, and good on you, that man. And everybody walks out feeling happy. It's a fascist myth with starring Mel Gibson.
Who's in the next film that we're going to talk about too. So you've actually chosen two Mel Gibson films.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love Mel on screen. But Mad Max is it's a Western, and it works as a three-act story. And if you look at Mad Max as being a cowboy, he's come from somewhere. And he's come out into the Badlands, and he goes and he saves a village that's being surrounded by bandits who want to get in and steal the gold and ravish the women. It's a straight-up Western. So in terms of genre films, it's one of the great Australian genre films, one of the most successful Australian films of all time. Because it's a genre film, it just happens to be wearing a leather jacket going up against guys with mohawks.
And it's set up this framework, I guess, for sci-fi post-apocalyptic worlds that America copied. It's one of those kind of few instances where we did something that has really kind of been the template ever since then and to this day for that post-apocalyptic wasteland world where you get the kind of punk guys in your mohawks. And yeah, it's got that framework that's it's not only a Western, but it's really kind of works as a science fiction post-apocalyptic film. And also, as a very Australian film, I can't imagine Mad Max 2 being anywhere else other than Australia. It's got kind of the Bruce Spence, that character.
Stork is a new Star Wars.
Yeah, which is such an Australian character. Yeah. So it's got an Australianness that is ours. But it's also, tips into genre in really clever, interesting ways. And I love that, it's been a benchmark that America's copied, which it hasn't happened too often.
And it's cool because you can be a genre film, but you can be a more than one genre film, but feel like to other people that it's just one. So I say this is a post-apocalyptic film. You said it's a Western film. I mean, it's a very accurate reading. It's a Western film. It's also a road action film.
It's a magnificent action film.
Yeah.
Like, it's really kind of set the template for action cinema as well in terms of, like, big, weird car chases. And, like, it's really done a lot, I think.
It's what we should be doing. We should be making more of this. If we've got Quentin Tarantino saying he's, jerking off to Mad Max 2, then, you know, I want to see that.
Why can't we be making more films? Like, why haven't we been making more films like this?
People figured that was an anomaly. Schools don't teach how to write Mad Max. The Mad Max came out of two guys who were just movie makers.
Yeah.
They never went to school and they weren't taught how to do this stuff. They just, I think, watched a Clint Eastwood movie and said, you know, if we change the haircuts, we could be onto something.
And swap the horses to cars.
Yeah.
And make the retro cars setting to a post-apocalyptic setting.
Cool cars.
And it's interesting, you're absolutely right. It is an anomaly and they don't teach this stuff. Although, perhaps ironically, there's been, three sequels to Mad Max and there's another one on the way with Tom Hardy, which apparently destroyed the remote country in which it was filmed. I just read something quick the other day about it. So Mad Max 4 is coming out. Do you think there's a danger with embracing genre filmmaking that you're also, by association, embracing sequel building and sequel making and franchise extensions?
Oh, yeah. I mean, these are the things that keep people fed. The audience likes going to see something with which they're familiar that has a new spin. And that's the essence of the sequel. Here's the film you liked before, but this time we've got lots of aliens.
So you're not spared by the sort of sequel, prequel, remake kind of... Because it's almost like craze. It's not so much a craze now, especially... I'm talking in American films. It's you know, it's a standard menu.
Yeah, although they burst out with a film like Avengers, which combined all of the new superheroes they'd launched. They launched Iron Man. Hey, that worked. They launched Captain America. Ooh, that worked. The next thing you know, they thought, well, why not bundle them all together and see if that works? So long as the writing is good, and Avengers was extraordinary writing, Joss Whedon's just a genius, then I don't mind it as something that the audience is familiar with. It's going to be popular, and it's going to sell, and it's going to keep people employed if we're worried about an industry.
Doesn't it engender lazy writing, though? Like, it, more often than not, if, like, once they've got the pre-existing property, they know it'll make money, and they'll just bang out pretty generic scripts. So, ideally, yeah, it would be great if there's amazing screenplays and creativity to these ideas, but the ideas kind of, and the sequelitis that's happening, kind of engenders laziness a little bit.
Mad Max 2 was better than Mad Max 1, which was great.
I can't argue with that.
Lawrence Kasdan's Empire Strikes Back was better than the first Star Wars.
I can't argue with that. The great sequel. Yeah.
Avengers is better than either of the two Iron Man films. I think that you can actually make sequels that get better and better because you're dealing... There's a lot of material that is in the film that can be taken for granted. And so you can just actually go to the heart of the characters without having to explain how Iron Man got his suit.
And I finally found an appropriate segue here because you mentioned Lawrence Kasdan and Empire Strikes Back.
Woohoo!
Now, how big is your collection of Star Wars toys?
Oh, wow. Can you pay the
I've been waiting on photos. I want... please, don't tell us.
You guys come across as so cool, and then you go and ask about the Star Wars toys.
It was coming.
I'm an R2-D2 doll right up there. It's a backpack.
I spotted that. That's good. Have you seen the R2-D2 t-shirt for girls?
I don't.
Oh, there's an R2-D2 bikini.
Have you got it?
A bikini? What parts are on?
Where am I going to read it?
Not on.
So the head is...
It's just kind of those buttons and the decals and all that stuff. I've got thousands of toys.
That, like, literally thousands of
thousands
Star Wars?
Thousands of
And
Star
do you still
Wars.
Collect them now?
No, I can't. Unless it's special.
Are these the only Star Wars... Like, did you cut it off with the end of the original trilogy?
Oh, yes, the first three.
So it's none of the prequels.
I bought one Jar Jar Binks bank, little... You know, you put your coins in the head. I bought that because I thought, maybe he'll last, but that was the last... You know, that was the last and only toy from the new franchise I bought.
I've got the... Barack Obama real change coin jar just up there. You're looking at it right now.
I love that. That is awesome. But Thank you. It's not just Star Wars. I got like Terminator and, you know, Freddy Krueger, and there was more than just Star Wars toys.
But it's our Star Wars. You got written up on the internet, numerous websites, including Wikipedia, for your Star Wars collection. And does it take up one room or multiple rooms? Or
it's all in storage. It's not. It's
all in storage.
Yeah, I don't want to get burgled because someone goes, let's go and steal all the toys. Although I did have a burgling situation. The cops came around and they were looking everywhere. And I said, you know, I just don't know why they didn't take the alien. And they said, what do you mean? There's an alien? And sure enough, you know, there's an original, you know,
well, at least
alien.
You're theoretically armed for close combat with your stick.
Yeah, I mean, they could have taken... They took all the DVDs and crap like that, and there's an alien they could have, you know, bought a car with. Morons. That's why we call them burglars. So, yeah, I just went through a period where I just loved the toys, and also I thought, if I'm going to leave something to my children, I don't want to make it real estate. I want it to be safer than that.
It's a more secure investment.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to inherit a gigantic Star Wars collection. On Wikipedia, I believe it says it's the third largest in the Southern Hemisphere, or the third largest.
That's right. What they say. There's a guy in there, and there's some other guy
somewhere.
It's
hard to quantify
else.
That, isn't it? You have to count each toy. How could you possibly measure?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. We take care of the two other guys, though.
I used to count them, and then I just went, I haven't got the time to be doing this, and it's stupid. What do I care? I'll never sell them. I just like playing with them.
Wow. Fantastic.
Keeps you young.
Well, to move on to a film that is...
Final film. The final of the four films?
Yes. Yes, the final film. Yes. Yeah. It's really nothing to do with the Star Wars universe. More the quintessential, in my mind, film about how sometimes if you're good in sport, and I never was particularly great at sport, if you are good at sport, and for example, you're a fast runner, maybe even you're a very fast runner, sometimes you just can't run fast enough. And
that's what you got out of this.
This is what I got out of the Peter Weir's classic war film, Gallipoli.
You can win a gold medal, but you can't save your mates.
Yes, which ends in a freeze frame, a very iconic freeze frame of the protagonist. I guess there's two protagonists, or I don't know, it's hard to have two, but I guess it's... I guess it's the protagonist.
It's Mel. Mel Gibson's the real protagonist.
It does come down to Mel.
For people wondering how you can pick the protagonist, because there are a lot of buddy movies, the protagonist is the person who has to travel the greatest emotional distance in the story. They're the one who you'll say, well, that's really...
And that is definitely the Gibson character.
So even though the film starts with the other character and follows him a little bit in the first act, it ends up being Mel's story.
Yeah, Mel's the one going...
Although having said that, the guy who ends up blasted full of bullets in slow-mo right before the credits, you know... He's got his stake to the property too.
He's got a total character arc there.
Yeah.
He does.
You just can't run fast enough. Run like a leopard, run like a tiger.
You're still going to get shot.
You're going to get a lot faster.
I always thought it was funny with Gallipoli, you know, what are your legs? Steel springs. What are they going to make you do? Go boing, 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 boing. You know, I always thought that was a joke they'd make, but they didn't.
Well, it did, yeah.
Go gadget legs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with Gallipoli, I rewatched it the other day, and it still is a great film. Like, it still came across as not just, I think, one of the best Australian films, but I think it is one of the best films, like, kind of around that topic ever made. It's such a perfectly constructed beast of a film. And what struck me on rewatching was the fact that it doesn't get to the war until two-thirds of the way through the film. Yeah. Like, I kept watching it, and I'm like, I'd totally forgotten that they wander the desert and there's all this Australiana at the start. Mm. And it's like an hour 10, an hour 20 before they even get to the war. And that, like...
What chance have they got?
Well, it's...
They're not even prepared.
It's... Because everyone kind of thinks of Gallipoli and they think of the trench scenes and they think of the kind of running over the trench into the bullets. And that's just a really minor part of the film. It really is kind of a friendship film. So I'm guessing you chose it because of its buddy characteristics.
Yeah, it's a buddy movie.
Yeah, it is.
It is, and of course, David Williamson and Peter Weir both worked very hard together on this, and these are two masters of their crafts, and apparently they came to blows, David Williamson was saying once. They actually came to... You can imagine the pathetic fist fight these two.
They'll write it out beforehand and try and outright the fist fight.
No, and the noises they would have made. they fought very long and hard over the film, and it's a buddy movie. And of course, the last few minutes are devastating because all this love that these characters have engendered through all their crazy and funny antics. We can see is about to be extinguished, and all of a sudden we don't want them to die. We don't want either of them to die, all their friends, but a whole bunch of them go over the trenches and get shot to pieces. So it's,
and it still works. Really effective. It's coming, but it just, like, the futility of war and the futility of everything just smashes you again. And watching it, I knew it was all coming, but damn, when they went over the trenches, I was like, why couldn't Mel run a little bit faster?
Yeah, come on, Mel. I mean, powered by Opus Dei. Get into it.
Come on. Your mouth off enough.
it's a perfect example of how the two masks that symbolize drama have to work. If you want people to cry, you can't just start straight away by trying to make them cry with, you know, a single mother who's also an author living in the inner city, who's contemplating suicide, who's wrestling with the memory of whatever the hell it was, pick a domestic crime against her, who just gets miserable and gets ripped off and then thrown out of her house, has her children taken away from her, and finally ends up down at St Kilda Beach.
You can't start already miserable and just sink down.
The trajectory. If she makes us smile and giggle, then we cry when she ends up finally looking out at St Kilda Beach with smack in her veins, because we know what we've lost. this is that the equation is so simple, and my voice is raised because I'm trying to bash it into Australian screenwriters who are uniformly ignorant. And why? Because they haven't sat in a room and listened to me or Steve Kaplan or Chris Anastasiades. They have not listened to what we're saying. And so they're writing this formless, dark, they think it's dark, it's just bleak build.
You start bad and then you just get worse. And that just doesn't, I guess, engender good drama. Like, and using Gallipoli as a framework, it was like, yeah, the first hour of that film is joyous. It's warm. It's really lovely. And then when it does end bleak, it's earned that.
And we cry. That's the thing. They put on Albanani's adagio. And there's not a dry seat in the house. Yeah. And how do you tell? Because you hear men coughing. What they're really doing is going, nyah, nyah, nyah. And that's how it works. You have the laughing mask and then you bring out the crying mask. And that's how it works. And if they don't surrender to this, then they will all die poor or worse in arts administration.
And it's almost that iconic image right at the end of Gallipoli. It's almost unspoilable. So if you had your time machine, you could go back, you know, call back to the Empire Strikes Back thing, then, you know, Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker's father, hey, waiting for people outside the... spoiler alert. waiting for people lining up to see the film. But if you join that line as they're going into Gallipoli, back when it was released, even if you said, you know, the protagonist in this film is going to die in the end, I don't think it would lessen the emotional impact.
Oh, yeah, you could do the spoiler alert. It's Gallipoli.
Mm.
We know.
It's not going to end.
Breaking news, people die. Yeah. But it's still very powerful. It's still amazingly powerful.
It's like Saving Private Ryan. You know, who do we kill? We kill the one that we love the most, and it's not Private Ryan. We kill Tom Hanks. And why? Because, damn it, this is D-Day. What did you think? You think you were going to get out of this with everybody walking out alive? You know, that Spielberg knows his stuff.
That bloody Matt Damon, though, he escaped. He escaped the war. Oh,
God. Well, he has Jason Bourne skills.
Yes.
He didn't know it then because he still had the memory loss, but he was
still finding it. Still finding it.
Deadpan. The deadpan guy always walks off the battlefield. Okay.
Well, I think that's, you know, a good note to end this terrific discussion on Australian genre cinema. Tim, that was amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
I too am amazed to sit here in the presence of you guys because you know more about film than I do with my pinky.
You silver-tongued devil. Yeah, so just to give your show a plug, it's playing at the Melbourne Comedy Festival in the first week. And remind me, it starts March 27th.
Yep, March 27, or let's make it March 28, just to go completely mad.
Make it an even 28.
It's called Carry a Big Stick. And why? Because I carry a big stick. We won awards. We've sold out everywhere. It's before it goes to the rest of the world, including China. Really? Come and see my show. I'm just saying.
you killed it in Shanghai.
I don't know.
The Chinese comedy scene is wrapped up tighter than the North Korean one. Come to the Melbourne Comedy Festival. You know, take your clothes off and dance at my show the first week, because in the second week I won't be.
If I do that or Rich does that, you're going to lose customers, I think. So we will come, but we will not be taking off our clothes, or at least Rich won't be taking off our clothes. Thank you again.
Thank you again, and let's discuss the nudity thing.